morning, everyone. I'd like to introduce Rabbi Jeremy Weider. Rabbi Weider is the Joseph and Gwendolyn Strauss Professor of Talmud in the Mezer Yeshiva Program, a Rosh Yeshiva at Reitz, and an Adjunct Professor of Bible at Yeshiva College. He graduated summa cum laude from Yeshiva College in 1991 and received an MS in American Jewish History from the Bernard Rebel Graduate School of Jewish Studies. He was ordained at Reitz and holds a PhD in Judaic Studies from New York University. It's my privilege to call upon Rabbi Weider.
Thank you, Julie. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. When I was a teenager and I was learning Maseches Chulin and Mishnayos, so I was learning the third perek, and the third perek speaks about, the third perek is Elu Trefos. It speaks about animals that have some type of defect, which the way the Mishnah seems to read, make it impossible for the animal to survive. And the Gemara has a discussion about whether or not an animal which we label as a trefa can survive 12 months, and generally the accepted conclusion, the Shulchan Aruch rules, that trefa in a chaya, that an animal which is considered a trefa that has one of these blemishes cannot survive for 12 months, and in situations where there is a doubt whether or not it has such a blemish, you're not sure, if it survives 12 months, that's proof that it's not trefa. So Mishnah actually lists some things that render the animal a trefa, and some things that are definitely not a trefa. So one of the things that the Mishnah lists as an animal that is definitely not a trefa is an animal whose kidneys are missing. If the kidneys are diseased, it's a trefa. But nitlu shtei klayos, if the two kidneys were gone, they were removed somehow, then the animal is not a trefa. Now, I'm still not any expert in biology, but it struck me as kind of odd that an animal without kidneys could survive. Now, it's pretty clear a human being without kidneys will not survive for more than a very, very short period of time. And so I went and I asked someone, a Talmud Chacham, and he just told me, you know, the Mishnah says what it says, and we accept that, and that was sort of the end of the conversation. It wasn't a very satisfactory answer. I didn't realize at the time that I was sort of stepping on a minefield, because this really is a topic that, even Ad Hayom Hazeh, is a very sensitive topic. And really, this is really one example of a conflict between science and halacha. And the title of the shir, when we talk about a conflict between science and halacha, makes actually two assumptions, both of which one could question. Firstly, the question that there could be a conflict between science and halacha. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, when you think about the discipline of science, science is what I would describe as descriptive, and religion, halacha, is prescriptive. So I often ask my students, from a scientific perspective, should you go to the top of this building and jump off headfirst onto the concrete sidewalk? And the correct answer to that question is, there is no answer scientifically. A scientist can tell you that if you jump off the top of this building headfirst onto the concrete sidewalk, you're probably going to die. If not, you'll be crippled for life, likely. This is a very small probability, that a large gust of wind will come and all of a sudden blow you at the right angle and you'll land on your feet safely. I wouldn't, frankly, take my chances on that. But from a scientific perspective, science doesn't tell you whether you should or shouldn't jump off the roof. It simply predicts what is likely to happen. Halacha, on the other hand, does not necessarily describe what's going to happen, but is prescriptive. It tells you what you should or shouldn't do. In order to decide whether you should jump off the roof, well, you first have to ask the question, if you are, let's say, Jewish, or you're probably Christian or Muslim or belong to a whole host of other religions, probably the answer to that question is no, because we value life, and therefore from a values perspective, you don't do something for no reason that endangers your life. If, however, your primary affiliation is that of the Hemlock Society, in which suicide is a noble choice and a good idea, so then maybe the answer is you should jump off the roof. But fundamentally speaking, Torah and science, halacha and science, address two totally different disciplines. So the question is, why would there ever be a conflict between science and halacha? I'll come back to that in a moment. The second assumption that is embodied in this is that from a Torah perspective or halachic perspective, we would even consider something that science has to say, if it comes into conflict with halacha, as being valid. In other words, I would sort of give the following analogy. There's a wonderful article on this topic by Professor Shlomo Sternberg. I don't know if he's still teaching. He's a professor of mathematics at Harvard. It was published in the Bar Ilan journal Badad, B'chod Vrachecha Da'ehu. It's like a Torah Mada journal. In the 1990s. So he published an article sort of surveying a lot of the material that relates to this topic, and he made a very interesting observation. For most of us, I assume almost everybody in this room, when you encounter something in halachic sources that from a scientific perspective seems to be completely wrong, your response is to dismiss. Our response is typically to say it is wrong and dismiss it. But the truth is, for most of us, how many of us have walked into a laboratory to actually prove that modern science is correct and the science of Chazal is wrong? Now, I'm not suggesting that therefore I dismiss modern science. I don't. But nonetheless, we take things on faith. Most scientists, if you're a biologist doing advanced work, so Professor Sternberg points out, you don't go back and do all the basic laboratory work to demonstrate that all the first principles of biology are true. You accept what your teachers teach you, you accept what's written in the textbooks. If you grew up in an environment where you received no science education, which could be true in certain parts of the Haredi world, and now someone tells you the following. The science textbook says X. The Gemara says Y. Any intelligent person under those circumstances, of course, is going to accept what the Gemara says and dismiss what the science textbook says. I would expect the person to do that. So some of what we talk about, the notion, we may take for granted that there can be a conflict between what Chazal say and what science says, and that we might even be considering the possibility of dismissing Chazal on a particular point and accepting science, but that in itself is an assumption that is not taken for granted in all quarters of the Orthodox world. And not only in parts of the Orthodox world where they have no secular education, even in the United States of America, where most people, maybe not in the Hasidic world, but most of the yeshiva world, people get some semblance of an education in mathematics and science a little bit. Nonetheless, there are many people who would simply, as a matter of principle, say that any time there's a conflict between what it says in the Gemara and what scientists tell us, that they would very rapidly dismiss what science has to say. Of course, I think it's a given that when there's no conflict, so you can, if you go to the hospital, I remember many years ago visiting the hospital, I think it was for special surgery or something like that, and you go to the waiting room and it's full of Hasidim, right? In other words, they know who the best doctors are, and they will take advantage and use correctly so all the best medicine available. But I don't know if they stop to sort of ask the question of how much of the medicine that's available to them and its fundamental principles conflicts with things that Chazal believed. It doesn't really matter. I don't think they think about that question. But I think that the idea, what many of us take for granted, that there can be a conflict and that we're going to have to struggle to reconcile or to justify what Chazal said, is not a given in all quarters of the Torah world. So those are really the two assumptions that are embodied in the whole notion of approaching this topic. Number one is that there can be a conflict between science and Torah, even though they fundamentally address two different disciplines. And number two, that we really would even consider what science has to say if it happens to conflict with Torah. Now, going back to the first question, I wanted to explain why is it that there actually sometimes does appear at least to be a conflict between Torah and science, and that is the following. Our source of halacha, our ultimate source, is the Talmud Bavli. The Talmud Bavli, fundamentally speaking, is a book of halacha, but it's not only a book of halacha. Number one, the application of halacha, obviously, depends upon mitzius, it depends upon the realia. So if you're a rav and you have to decide whether or not someone can desecrate the Shabbos to save a life, you have to first decide whether that life is endangered. And that is fundamentally a medical or a scientific assessment. So the Gemara in the 8th Perek in Yoma discusses a number of conditions which were considered life-threatening, a number of things were not considered life-threatening. Modern medicine might disagree, possibly in both directions. So even though, fundamentally speaking, there's no real conflict between halacha and its purest form, And science, nonetheless, because Chazal, the Gemara is not just an abstract work. It also applies the halacha to various situations. So you might find that their assumptions that they used in applying the halacha might conflict with the assumptions that we begin with. In addition, you have to remember that the Talmud Bavli is not only a work of halacha, and it's not only a work of Haggadah. The Talmud Bavli, as to borrow the expression of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, is bolul bakol. It is a mixture of everything. The Talmud Bavli contains in not only halacha, not only Haggadah, which we might term as philosophy, hashkafa, it embodies folklore, medicine, science, history. So one can debate, not for now, to what extent one believes all of those other disciplines are considered normative or binding, But for starters, there is a lot of scientific material, scientific assertions that are found in the Talmud Bavli, even in contexts that are not primarily halachic. The Gemara at the beginning of the 7th chapter of Gittin has an extensive section, most of us like to skip this one, we learned Gittin, of remedies and medicines that they believe to be efficacious for all sorts of conditions. The Gaonim already write, we don't follow those remedies, but nonetheless, and there's no halachic import of those passages in the Gemara, there's no hashkafic import. You want to cure hepatitis, so you take pigeons and you hold them over the stomach of the person who has the hepatitis, and when the pigeons stop dying, the hepatitis is gone. There are people, by the way, you still do this today. But the point is, these have no halachic import whatsoever, and nonetheless, they're found in the Gemara. So we might say, you know, that we wouldn't use this as a cure for hepatitis, we would look to something else. But that is why there sometimes are, in fact, conflicts between halacha and science, Torah and science, even though at their core, they really exist on parallel tracks that never meet, because Torah is prescriptive, whereas science is descriptive. Now, coming to the second question, which is really what I want to focus my attention on, which is the question of what does one do when faced with a conflict between Chazal science, and particularly when Chazal science has halachic import, versus contemporary science. So my position on this, and I suspect the position probably of most people in our community is clear, I'm not so much interested in pushing one position or another, but I would like to show you that this issue is something that has been struggled with, it has been a battle for a very long time. And I really have broken down the sources into sort of three periods, that of the Gemara, in which fundamentally I think there was really only one attitude, but then in the Rishonim and in the Achronim, in the medieval and the modern periods, the conflict really emerges full flower, I guess. One of the reasons for that is that my sense in Chazal did not have so much an intellectual conflict with their contemporaries. They certainly have dialogue, but there wasn't within the Jewish community. There were divisions, but I don't know how often they were sort of philosophical, scientific divisions. In the medieval period, you already have a major struggle between the rationalists and the mystics, if you want to call them, and that struggle continues on into the modern period, so you really find two camps of thought. First, I wanted to look at the Gemaras. So I've chosen a few Gemaras here. The first one is a discussion about embryology. And the Gemara Nida, there is a well-known halacha, it's a pasuk in Parshas Tazria, that if a woman gives birth to a male offspring, so the woman is ritually impure, she's tameah for 40 days. If she gives birth to female offspring, she's ritually impure for 80 days. The details aren't important, but there's a 40 and 80 distinction. Now, the Gemara has a notion which seems to be pretty common, that Yetziras Havlad takes place at 40 days. I'm not interested in talking about is there any scientific basis for that. It's a halachic statement. There has to be a dividing point, a line which we say the fetus now has some type of a status for various halachic purposes, maybe for being a life, maybe for regarding the mother as pregnant for the purposes of an Ashes Kohen, or Bas Kohen not eating Truma, whatever it is. At some point we say there has to be Yetziras HaVlad. The Vlad is already considered having a certain form or shape. The question is, when does that take place for a female? Now, from certainly a modern biological perspective, there's no difference between the formation of male and female in terms of the larger organs. The differentiation of sex may take place sometime in that neighborhood and may start to develop, but fundamentally the Yetziras HaVlad is whatever it is. It doesn't differ between male and female. And that, in fact, is the opinion of the Chachamim in the Mishnah in Nida, and that's the way we paskin. That Yetziras HaVlad is 40 days, period. Male, female, doesn't matter. But Rabbi Yishmael was of the opinion, and he clearly was influenced by the Psukim, which don't talk about that. The Psukim just talk about Tumah. He was influenced by the Psukim and had this idea that the Yetziras HaVlad, the formation of the embryo, is considered partially complete at 40 days for male and 80 days for female. So the question, of course, is how do they try to decide the issue? So the Gemara tells a story in the first source. Rabbi Yishmael, they told Rabbi Yishmael that Cleopatra, the queen in Alexandria, so a couple of her maidservants were sentenced to death. So they killed them, and they did an autopsy, and they discovered a male and female offspring in her, and it was at 40 days at that point, 41 days, and they were both fully formed. So you see that the formation of a male and female offspring
is completed by 41 days, there is no difference. Now notice, what was the basis of the proof? Something that modern science would relate to very well, Aristotle maybe not as much. Observation, experiment. That's really what they were appealing to. But the response of Rabbi Yishmael is very interesting at first glance. He says, Amar lahem, ani me'vilachem raya min ha-Torah. It's on the end of the third line. Ani me'vilachem raya min ha-Torah. I'm bringing you proof from the psukim in the Torah, where it's 40 days of tumah for a male offspring, 80 days for a female offspring. Va'atem me'vilachem raya min ha-Shotim. You're bringing me proofs from fools. So apparently the scientists, or those who did the scientific experiment, were fools. Now initially, when you look at Rabbi Yishmael, at least as it's presented, he's saying, I don't care what science has to say. The Torah says X, and that's enough. Now the truth is, we might agree with Rabbi Yishmael, except that the Torah doesn't exactly say X. The Torah tells us the halacha in one area. The question is, does that have impact in the other area? And what's most striking is when you look at the Talmud Bavli's comments on this brisa. The Bavli says, Umay raya min ha-shotim. They asked, how was Rabbi Yishmael dismissing this? Why was it a raya min ha-shotim? Now, if I didn't read on in the Gemara, I would have said it's simple. It's a raya min ha-shotim because we don't ask scientists the question. We don't do experiments. We just accept whatever the Torah says. But Gemara says, no. The raya min ha-shotim was not that you don't ask scientists. It's that you have to ask good scientists. You have to do good experiments. You have to have controls. Why? Amar nekeva kadam the abar ba'an yom kamei zachar. How do you know that the maidservant with the female child became pregnant 40 days before? Maybe she was already pregnant from 80 days before. So she was 80 days pregnant. The other maidservant was 40 days pregnant. And that's why each one had a fully formed fetus. So what you see from the Gemara is that nobody contested the basic premise of doing an experiment and using empirical data to determine your results. The argument was over whether the experiments were good experiments or not. A second example, which is maybe one of the most, it's a very famous Gemara. We usually assume, I think all of us assume, that when the sun sets in the west at night, and it gets back, the next morning, magically, it appears in the east. We generally assume that the earth is round. It goes around the sun while the earth is rotating. And that's why the sun comes back next morning in the east. But you have to remember from the perspective of ancient man and woman that this was a puzzle. Right? They didn't have satellites. Not everybody believed the earth was round. And therefore, they were really wondered, how does this happen? And there were basically two competing theories as to where did the sun go at night and how did it get to the other side. So the Gemara quotes the following. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, the Gemara says that the Chachmei Yisrael say that the sun goes underneath the Rakia during the day. Now you have to remember the ancient cosmology and down through to the medieval period. Okay, until probably the Copernican Revolution. So they believe that the Rakia, as the word suggests, was a solid. It was stretched out. And it was impermeable. You couldn't see through it. So the Chachmei Yisrael say that during the day the sun goes underneath the Rakia. That's why we see the sun. At night it goes above the Rakia, which means it goes into the Rakia, goes somehow, gets behind the Rakia. At night it travels back west to east. And the next morning comes back underneath at the east. And the truth is, without any other evidence, it's a perfectly reasonable explanation. That's what Chachmei Yisrael said. What did Chachmei Umos HaOlam say? Chachmei Umos HaOlam said that during the day it goes underneath the Rakia, and at night it goes underneath the Karka. It goes underneath the earth. Now, that is what we would describe, at least from our perspective, basically correct. But that was the Machlokas. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi comes along, the author of the Mishnah comes along and says, Nirin Divrehem Mitvarenu. Their opinion would appear to be more correct than ours. Now that in itself is an interesting statement. Most read that statement as Rabbi Yehuda Nasi said, they're right and we're wrong. Rabbeinu Tam, interestingly enough, and the whole basis of weighing Rabbeinu Tam's tzeis is based upon the assumption that only Nirim Divrei Midvareinu, their words appear to be more correct than ours, but in fact we're right and they're wrong. But I'm going to put Rabbeinu Tam's sheet aside for the moment. What is Rebbe's proof? What is Rebbe's proof that they're right and we're wrong? And this in itself is fascinating. He says, because the hot springs are warmer at night than they are during the day. Now, just a comment about why that appears to be so, even though it's probably not true. The air is colder at night. When you step out of the hot springs, you feel much colder. Therefore, you assume that the hot springs are warmer. During the day, when the air is warmer, you don't feel the temperature differential. That's what my assumption is. What Rebbe was describing was an observed phenomenon. I don't question that. But I assume it wasn't with a thermometer. It was just with a human being's sense of the temperature. So, What's fascinating about Rebbe's proof is that it's predicated upon an assumption that the earth is flat or hemispheric. Because the only way that the sun is close, why the hot springs warmer at night? Because the sun is closer to the source of the hot springs. That only works if you assume that the earth wasn't round. Whether you assume it's flat or you assume it's a hemisphere with a flat bottom. Either way, Rebbe's proof that the Chachmei Yisrael were correct was based upon in itself a scientific error, which is interesting. But clearly, putting aside Rabbeinu Tam's view of the Gemara, on what basis does Rebbe decide that they're right and we're wrong scientifically? The answer is because observation would suggest that they are in fact correct. Again, I don't care whether you think the experiment was a good experiment or not, it's the methodology that's striking. In other words, Rebbe accepts the fundamental methodology. How well you design your experiments is a separate question. The last particular source, which actually has enormous ramifications, halacha l'maisa, we're not going to really talk about it, but it relates to the status of oats in halacha, whether oats are considered a grain, is a Gemara Yerushalmi in Psachim. The Yerushalmi deals with the following question. There is a debate whether or not rice or millet can become chametz and can be used for matzah. There's a debate about a few different kinds of cereal grains. We paskin that it's only the five grains, the chameshes minei dagan, whatever they are. But the Yerushalmi, why is it, what's the debate about rice and millet? The debate is whether or not rice can leaven or it can only ferment. Anything with sugar in it will ferment. But in order to rise like a dough, it needs to leaven, whatever is required for that. So the Yerushalmi asks a very basic question. What are they busy arguing about whether or not rice can become chametz or not? Just do an experiment. So the Yerushalmi says they did an experiment, but they couldn't agree on what the results were. My explanation, by the way, of that is that most grains, the assumption we usually make is that to become chametz, something needs the protein gluten, the same protein that creates problems for people who have celiac. And most grains, even those that have gluten, like rye and barley, do not have a lot of gluten, and therefore, if you make it with just that grain, if you make just pure rye bread, that's not what the bakeries don't sell pure rye bread. They sell wheat bread with a few rye seeds. But if you have pure rye bread, it's a very, very dense loaf. It doesn't rise very much. And that might be why it's very hard to tell the difference between fermentation and leavening when you're dealing with a substance that doesn't rise very much. So rice bread and barley bread might look the same. It's very hard to tell. And we know that correctly so that barley has gluten and barley can become chametz. So you're not sure, though, is rice the same as barley or not. But whatever the explanation is, the Yerushalmi says they did experiments, but they couldn't agree on what the results were. They argued on what the experiments taught us. So I think that the hallmark of Chazal generally is that they did regard empirical evidence as sufficient to determine scientific reality, and that would simply carry over into the halacha. Whatever the science was would be applied to the halacha. And I don't think Chazal really faced fundamental conflict. But when you get to the medieval period, this becomes a major struggle. One camp, which was really represented by the Gaonim and the Rambam, and even perhaps the Ramban, was that Chazal's science was not a Kabbalah. The Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim, it's the passage I have here, number 4, the Rambam says, don't complain when Chazal's science seems absurd. It's not their fault. Chazal weren't scientists, or at the very least, they consulted with the scientists of their time. Maybe some of them were scientists. You can't fault them that scientific knowledge was not so advanced in their time. The Rambam says that it's not a Kabbalah. If the science is wrong, it's not because we should view Chazal in any negative light. Just as today, some of the science that was assumed 30 years ago is assumed to be wrong today, and you can rest assured that there are scientific assumptions today that will be assumed to have been wrong in 30 years, and they'll wonder how could we have possibly thought such silly things. But the reality is that is the nature of science. So the Rambam says, you can't hold Chazal responsible for that. There's also a much more cited passage of Rav Avram ben HaRambam. It's printed as the introduction to the Ein Yaakov, the collection of Agadah on the Talmud Bavli. So there's an introduction of he didn't write it as an introduction to the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov postdated him. But it was a comment that Rav Avram ben HaRambam wrote about science, and he said, God forbid anybody should think that we should accept Chazal as authorities on matters of science. Chazal are authorities on the matter of halacha, not on science. And it's absolutely, he says, it's forbidden miderech haTorah or miderech haSeichel to accept the scientific statement of Chazal just because Chazal said it. Just because they said it. So that was the Rambam's view. However, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, one of the most influential halachic figures, maybe the most influential halachic Rishon, was the Rashba. Rav Shlomo ben Aderet of Barcelona. And the Rashba, in a couple of different contexts, really challenges the scientific enterprise. In one context, he was actually not dealing with something that had halachic import. He was dealing with the major debate that raged in the medieval period about science, not related to halacha, was the Aristotelian notion of the eternity of the universe. Had the universe always been? And this was a major, major philosophical, scientific debate. And there were some Rishonim who were willing to count them as the idea, not quite the Aristotelian view, but some alternative view that the universe was eternal. Ibn Ezra is one of those, and his comments about Bereishis Bara Elokim, he understands that it's not creation ex nihilo. There were others also who assumed this. The Rashba does not take very kindly to the suggestion, and in his discussion, one of the things he points out is that scientists themselves don't understand everything. So maybe their science is wrong. He cites a fascinating example. If you look on the bottom of page 3, the Rashba writes that the Yoser Mizani Ro at source 5, the Yoser Mizani Ro min atema bedivrayim. I wonder about what they write. Shehem be'emes modem she'en chakirasa maseges lamitas teva nimtzos. They admit that they don't understand the nature of everything. All physical matter has properties that we don't fully understand. And he goes on to cite the example of the stone which attracts the iron even though there's no physical contact between the objects. Now, we usually assume if you want to move one object, you have to push it. The idea that I can push it without touching it is very strange. Now, of course, you all know something called magnetism. We can quantify it, we can describe it, I don't know if we fully understand it. But the medievals couldn't even quite quantify it, but they could observe the phenomenon. So the Rashba says, you see, they don't understand everything. In another tshuva, which is the next source, the Rashba, now we bring it back to what I started with about trefos. One of the trefos that the Mishnah lists is that if it's missing a leg, if a leg is cut off above a certain point. So someone wrote a letter to the Rashba saying they had such an animal, and the animal lived more than 12 months. And the Rashba goes crazy. He says, absolutely, they're lying, it's wrong, they must have misseen, they don't know what we're talking about, how can you tell us? Chazal said the animal will die, therefore, no matter what they say, they're wrong. That was the Rashba's response. Which is a very reasonable response if you can't see the experiment yourself. Right? It becomes a response that's harder to explain. Again, you can explain the Rashba, he didn't see it. It becomes a more difficult proposition in the modern period when it is easier to demonstrate that some of these trefos that the Mishnah says are trefos don't die, or some of these trefos, some of these animals which the Mishnah says are not a trefa, most certainly will die. And speaking, by the way, about that kidney example that I quoted earlier, in Professor Sternberg's essay, he points out something fascinating. We wouldn't survive without kidneys for more than a day or two, but apparently they did some experiments on ruminants, cows, where they took out the kidneys, and these animals actually could have lived. They lived a couple of weeks, and then they shechted and did an autopsy, but the animals probably could have lived a month, because apparently in animals that chew their cud, some of the functions of the human kidney are actually done by the stomach. So it doesn't solve the problem of the Mishnah, because the animals would not have survived 12 months. They were becoming anorexic, they probably would have died soon anyway. But nonetheless, it is interesting that there are some things that would have surprised you about kidneys of animals. But at the end of the day, we're still going to be left with the problem that there are examples of trefos which clearly survive, and some of the examples which are not trefa, which clearly die. But this was, in fact, this was the Rashba's response. It was simply to say, your science is wrong. Again, he didn't say, I observe it, but I don't care. He said, your observations are false. In some level, he's still acknowledging the scientific, the validity of the scientific method. The last medieval source that I bring to your attention was the Rashba's Rebbe, the Ramban. The Ramban was a very interesting figure. I don't want to elaborate much other than to say, despite the fact that he was a Kabbalist, he was also a rationalist. And this you can see in a number of places. In this particular case, the Ramban asks a very, very simple question. I mentioned earlier that the Gemara has a debate whether trefa chaya or trefa eino chaya. Can an animal which has one of the things identified as a trefa, can it survive 12 months or not? So the Ramban, at the beginning of the third parak in Chulin, asks a very simple question. Why were they busy arguing about this? Why didn't they just do an experiment? See? So the Ramban says, like the Yushalmi, and he quotes the Yushalmi from Sachem, he said they did, but they couldn't agree on the results of the experiment. Why? because they took a bunch of animals that were trefos and they locked them up to observe them. I mean, they fed them, but otherwise they would have died of starvation. But they put them aside and they watched them. And guess what? All of them died within 12 months. So if you believe that trefa enochai, it can't survive, you say, aha, there's my proof. But of course, as you can all readily see what's coming, if you believe that trefa chaya, you would say, yeah, you took 100 animals, they all died. But if you took the 101st animal, maybe that one would have lived. The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Right? So the fact that most animals, and this should be noted, everybody probably agrees, most trefos are going to, trefos are sick animals for Chazal. Everybody agrees at least that most of them will die within 12 months. The question is, can some of them survive? So the Ramban here clearly valued the experimental method, and he just says that they simply weren't able to determine whether or not it was what the correct results were. Okay, finally, when you come down to the modern period, and for reasons that I'm not going to go into now, I think that in the modern period, science became the enemy of religion. It clearly, for the Rambam, and even on some level for the Rashba, to a lesser extent, science and religion were not necessarily enemies. However, for whatever historical reasons, science and religion in the modern period became powerful enemies. And therefore, I would say that for the first time, you get very situations where you would clearly expect people to acknowledge some validity of science, but it is simply dismissed out of hand. The letter that I reprinted here from Rav Sternbach, which didn't relate to halacha, scientific impact upon halacha, but it was related to the Nussan-Slifkin controversy over the age of the universe. So if you read Rav Sternbach's letter, so you will see that he's not challenging the premise of a particular experiment. He's not challenging whether carbon-14 dating is valid or not. He's denying the entire scientific enterprise as practiced by scientists because they are anti-God. In other words, we're not going to quibble and discuss and analyze the particular scientific arguments because they're irrelevant. We know that the scientists are all apikorsim, or almost all of them apikorsim, and therefore we don't really care what they have to say. And again, I'm not presenting that. I need to present that in a pejorative sense. I understand exactly where that's coming from. In the discourse of halacha, I've chosen one example here, which I think really highlights where it really shows itself. There is a Gemara in Nida that states that there are three partners in the formation of a human being: father, mother, and God. And each one gives a person different parts. The father gives him the white parts, and the Gemara lists a series of things that are the white parts. Probably the bones are there, you know, all sorts of things, the lovin shabai and the white part of the eye. The mother gives the child the red parts. And presumably, it's fair to assume amongst those things, some yourselves in the Gemara don't have it, but you can assume dam, the blood, is part of that. And then God provides the ruach and the neshama. And when a person dies, God takes his part back and he leaves the remainder. That's what the Gemara says. Now, if I had read this, I would have simply stated, this is an agada. It's an agada with no import. At least halachically. It might be significant on some level, whatever you want to learn from it, but it's not something of great and halachic importance. However, it actually does matter halachically. And before the invention of blood testing, the issue was already an issue. Why? It had to do with Misha Mesu Echav Mechamas Mila. If someone had siblings who died because of bris mila, which today we likely assume in most cases is probably hemophilia, which is, I'm not going to talk about it now, but it is interesting there because I believe hemophilia is transmitted on the mother's line. But the question is, if someone's brother died, but they were only a half brother from the father, do you then assume that you don't do the bris mila on the next child, right? And if the blood comes from the mother, then the answer is the death of a half brother from the father should have no impact upon the mila. I'm going to put that question aside for the moment, but the modern incarnation of that discussion, and that was at a time where nobody was questioning the scientific assumption that the red parts come from the mother. But the question emerges in the modern period for paternity testing, let's say for child support. So until the invention of DNA testing, so blood testing could be used not to prove paternity, not to prove that someone was a child's father, but to disprove paternity. In other words, if the blood types didn't match in a certain way, then you know that this man cannot be the child's father. Okay, and therefore he would be exempt from mizelnos for the child. So the Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva, Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, in which he was asked about this question. And he says, he quotes the Gemara, and he says, we can't rely upon blood testing to disprove paternity. Now, he wasn't blind to the fact that someone was going to say, what about the entire scientific enterprise? But he writes, he was sensitive. He is engaged in what we might call science denial, but carefully. He writes at the end, on page number 6, it's at the end of source 9, the last sort of big paragraph. He says, "Kisnif nosaf halamor yesh lahosif ganzos." As an additional point, I want to add on the following. That the scientific determination in this case, ayidei bedikas suge hadam, by investigating blood types, einena yotzeis al kopan migeder hashara shel basherusham. It's a guess. It's not really solid. Hashara means an estimation. Why? Kefisha anu roim baharbe mikrim shemasha hamada kovei levados kayon. There are many things which science asserts definitively today. Kavur zman ma kovas baatzma cheres. A little time passes, and they make the opposite determination. And that which that they asserted with absolute certitude yesterday, today they say is nonsense. So he says, that's the result of new scientific discoveries. The Gedolei HaPoskim say you don't rely upon the estimates or the guesses of the doctors. It's not the same thing when the scientist observes something with a microscope or with a picture or something like that. There, of course, you have to follow them. It's a very, very interesting comment that the Tzitz Eliezer has, because clearly he's grappling. He doesn't want to be, I'll call it, a postmodern nihilist who would deny the reality of anything. But he doesn't, on the other hand, want to set aside this particular Gemara. So his suggestion is that you have to know what is good science and what is bad science. I suspect that he failed to sort of recognize that even that which you see with your eyes doesn't mean anything unless you have a context to interpret it. If you look at the discussion in the 19th century, I think it was called the homuncular theory, where they looked under a microscope and they saw sperm swimming and it looked like the image of a person. And you're right, the Teferis Yisrael, I think, writes, and now we understand why someone who is Motzi Zer Levatala is like Yishofech Dam. Right? It's like, the Gemara says, it's like Yishofech Dam, it's like he's murdering. She says, now we understand, because under the microscope you look at it and you see like it's little people. Now, they only saw little people there because they were prepared to see little people there. Obviously, even what we sense with our eyes can be deceptive. So this distinction between what scientists make as a hashara and that which can be observed with the eyes is very much an artificial distinction. Obviously, on a scientific balabatish level, it's very appealing. Right? That which you at least can see with your eyes, or you think you see with your eyes, is much more compelling than something which is just, take my word for it, that we've done experiments with the blood types and this is why it is. But that was the Tzitz Eliezer's response. Rav Herzog, the late chief rabbi, I think he was the first chief rabbi, Ashkenazic chief rabbi at the founding of the Medina. So he writes, this was not actually to Tzitz Eliezer, it was to someone else. This is from Professor Sternberg's article. He writes that he's flabbergasted, he's embarrassed. You know, he says that science, a number of people have written this, that science was once a completely different enterprise. Until you got to the modern period, so it was very plausible. It was very plausible to accept the science of Chazal and not challenge it. In other words, until you get to the early modern period or the late medieval period, the Aristotelian paradigm of science was basically still intact. And it was possible to defend a lot of the scientific statements found in Chazal. It was very reasonable and rational for someone like the Rashba to still be defending rabbinic scientific statements. But with the scientific revolution in the modern era, Sir Herzog writes, and others write, that it simply becomes inconceivable that anyone would be defending the old scientific paradigms. I'm not one to defend the old scientific paradigms or to deny the difference between ancient and modern science. But Rav Herzog's view represents a very modern view, not a very postmodern view. And there's a very, very famous work by Hume, talking about scientific revolutions in which, I'm not a big fan of it, but it should be noted for intellectual honesty's sake, where there are a lot of people today who would challenge the notion that science is absolute or exists independently of a social context. I think it is taken far further than it is justified, but I think that the point still needs to be made that even science, we may believe that modern science is far more accurate than ancient science. I certainly do. But you have to realize that even modern science has its limitations. Social context very often determines the way scientists view things. One of the examples that that is often pointed out is that the description of fertilization in the human being was often presented as really the function of how the male sperm sort of penetrate the female egg. And later, and that reflected a very male-oriented way of looking at the world. And later, sort of the way it's been described is somewhat quite different, that the female egg rather chooses which sperm it's going to take in. And again, I'm not saying there's no practical nafkamina lalacha that way, but even the way you choose to describe things is often dictated by the constraints of the world in which you live. So again, I don't think that may have matter for scientific purposes. And I'm not defending the Tzitz Eliezer's approach. It's not the approach I would take. It's not the approach my rabbeim take. But nonetheless, I think it's important to try to understand the worldview that they're coming from. We, as a community, for the most part, might adopt the particular approach that I'm about to talk about, but I think that one has to still have a healthy degree of respect for people who sort of reject that approach. Now, I want to conclude, after having sort of presented a little bit of historical overview, and many, even if you don't like what I have to say, the sources are among the most interesting sources you typically encounter. I wanted to talk about how Poskim do deal with the problem. Now, here we've seen already two approaches. One approach, which was that of the Tzitz Eliezer, and many others, and the Rashba, is to dismiss the scientific claims, accept the science of Chazal, and we don't have any questions. The opposite approach, which was Herzog's approach, and the Professor Sternberg, who was close with both Rav Moshe and the Rav, attributed from first-hand knowledge this approach to both of them, was to say that in most cases, the halacha remains the same fundamentally, but we update the application of the halacha based upon the new scientific consensus. So those are sort of two opposite, very extreme approaches. One denies the science of Chazal, and one dismisses the science of Chazal. Of course, you don't always have to take either. Now, there are people who take a hybrid approach. In fact, one of the things that should be pointed out is that probably Rav Moshe generally accepts the approach that Rav Herzog adopts as well, but not when it came to Hilchos Trefos. When it came to Hilchos Trefos are sort of encased in a solid glass case, and if you try to take a hammer and break it, the alarm goes off. We don't touch Hilchos Trefos. Hilchos Trefos are what they are. Anything mentioned in the Mishnah that renders the animal not a trefa is not a trefa. Anything that renders it a trefa, no matter how long the veterinarians tell you it will live, is still a trefa. If we have a new case, we'll go to the veterinarians and say, we have a new blemish, will this blemish kill the animal in 12 months or not? But anything that's in the Mishnah, we're simply not going to touch. But on the whole, Poskim, such as the Rav and Rav Moshe, would adopt the approach of, okay, the science has changed, now the halacha doesn't change, but the application of halacha changes. By way of a counterexample, where all Poskim accept the change in halacha, is when it comes to Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos. Today, I'm sure that any Rav across the entire spectrum of the Torah world will say that when you have a case where you're not sure whether the patient's life is in danger or not, you'll ask the doctors, and as a matter of principle, we rely upon what the doctors tell us. It doesn't matter what the Gemara said about a particular condition. When it comes to threat to human life, we listen to modern medicine. There are two other approaches that Professor Sternberg mentions, which are interesting, which are different kinds of approaches of dealing with this problem. The first he attributes to the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish's approach was that, yes, modern science is correct. But he also says, perhaps, that Chazal science was also correct. But laws of nature have changed. Now, there are cases where such an approach is actually plausible. There are cases where environmental factors do affect certain aspects of human and animal biology. And in some of the cases that are spoken about where this issue is raised, it actually is scientifically plausible. There are cases where it's not scientifically plausible, but I'm not going to go into that particular case. It's fair to say that gross human anatomy hasn't changed much in the last 2,000 years. But accepting that principle for the moment, that nishtanu atzvayim, that nature has changed, and the Chazon Ish didn't invent that phrase. That phrase is already found in the Rishonim, and it's found in the Rama and Shulchan Aruch in a certain context. But assuming that the scientific laws have changed, but the Chazon Ish says that the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says that the world is 6,000 years. 2,000 years of Tohu,
emptiness, 2,000 years of Torah, and 2,000 years of Yemos HaMashiach, but because of our sins, we've lost most of Yemos HaMashiach. Still waiting. So the Chazon Ish says that, what does it mean that there are 2,000 years of Torah? So he says that at the end of 2,000 years of Torah, that was the end of the period in which Chazal made certain determinations for Halacha, and whatever determinations they made at that point, and he says that's the time of Ravina and Ravashi, who finished the Gemara. Now, the numbers actually don't work. To the end of the 4,000 years is around the year 240, long before the time that the Gemara was finished, long before Ravina and Ravashi, but accept it for the moment. At the end of the 2,000 years of Torah, whatever halachic determinations had been made based upon a certain science, those are binding even if the science changes. That was the Chazon Ish's position. So again, it may be an oversimplification, but that's his basic approach. So what that means basically is, yeah, of course our science is correct, but it doesn't matter for halachic purposes because the halacha is dependent upon what the science was at the time of the end of the 2,000 years of Torah. Okay, that's a third approach. And the fourth approach, which he attributes to Rav Dessler, I actually heard an example of this many, many years ago, in 1987, I think it was, in the Torah Mada lecture delivered in YU's Lamport Auditorium by Rav Aaron Salvechik, Zichrono Livracha, where he was talking about a well-known scientific problem. The Gemara in Shabbos, in the first parak, speaks about two different kinds of lice, one of which you're allowed to kill on Shabbos, and one of which you're not allowed to kill. The one that you're allowed to kill, the Gemara says, is because it's not para virave. The simple reading of that expression, the way Rashi reads and the way the Mishnah Berurah is still reading, is it spontaneously generates. I mean, it doesn't have zachar in the keva. However, while there is such a thing actually as asexual reproduction in rare instances in nature, we generally assume that Pasteur's experiments demonstrated that there is no spontaneous generation. And in fact, when the flies grow out of the meat, it's because eggs were laid and fertilized, not because they grew on their own. So the question is, what do you do now? So Rav Aaron Salavechik, in this thing, tried to explain, he reinterpreted the Gemara. He said, Eina Parva Rava doesn't mean that it spontaneously generates. It means it doesn't grow in a healthy environment. It grows in a rotting environment. Things that grow in a rotting environment are not considered Parva Rava. Okay, whether you like the approach or not, it doesn't really matter, but it represents a model of saying, look, the halacha that the Gemara gave was correct. It must have been a Kabbalah or a Mesorah, it was a received tradition, that was the halacha. The Gemara gave a reason, so either the reason was wrong, but the din was still correct, or we misunderstood what the reason was, and we simply now have to understand the reason in the correct light. So that's a case of basically leaving the halacha intact, not denying modern science, and either saying that the Chachamim got the reason wrong, but the din was still a correct, it was a Mesorah, or that you have to understand actually what Chazal were talking about. Okay. So anyway, so that was a sort of a fourth approach to how to resolve conflicts between science and halacha. Dismiss the science, reapply the halacha in accepting the science, dismissing Chazal science. Number three was to say that the science has changed, but the halacha was determined based upon the science at the time halacha was set. And number four is to say that the halacha is correct, but the reason given is wrong, or the reason given was misunderstood. Before I conclude, I want to mention just two examples, which I'm not going to talk about the practical application, but to demonstrate where we live with a certain dissonance of conflict between Chazal science and our science. Number one is the practice of not eating meat and fish together. The Gemara Psachim, Daf Ayin Vav, states that you're not supposed to have meat and fish that were roasted in the same oven because it's kasher l'davar acher, it's bad for tzaras. Okay, the Rambam omits this din, presumably because he didn't accept its scientific basis, but the Shulchan Aruch quotes it. Most people today still are careful about separating fish and meat. That's one example. The other example, which is very much halacha l'maisa today, is v'sein talamata l'vracha. You're supposed to start reciting v'sein talamata l'vracha in chutz la'aretz, 60 days after the autumnal equinox. That's the halacha. For those of you who know even the most basic astronomy, the autumnal equinox was around September 22nd, which means that sometime in the last week, we should have started the same Talmud Tavracha. The reason we don't is because for the purposes of the same Talmud Tavracha, we are following what's known as the Kufa Shmuel, that the world, that a year, a solar year, is exactly 365 and a quarter days. Problem is that at least it's not. It's about 11 plus minutes too long, and over the course of the last 1600 to 1800 years, the autumnal equinox, as calculated by Tkufa Shmuel, has been creeping later and later and later, which is why if you look back at Sidurim that were printed around 1900, you will see that it tells you that you start saying V'sein Talamata Levracha either on December 3rd or 4th. If you open the art scroll now, it probably says 4th or 5th. come back in 50 years and the new art scrolls are going to say December 5th or 6th. I'm not saying what we do. I'm just telling you that that is one of the sort of classic problems. If you search, I don't remember where it is, Ramosha has a tshuva about this. It's very interesting to see his response. Anyway, so that I hope I've given you some sort of food for thought regarding this particular issue. I want to just conclude with sort of a personal perspective. One which is probably not so different than most people in our community. It's certainly one that Moed Rabbi Rav Shechter approached that he certainly assumes. And I think most of my colleagues at Yeshiva assume as well in one form or another. I would say that the Medrash in Eicha Rabba states that im yomar lecha adam chachma bagoyim tame. If a person says that there is chachma bagoyim, you should believe it. But if they say Torah bagoyim, al tame. What's the difference between chachma and Torah? Torah means values. It's how we live our lives. And our values are derived from the Torah. They're not derived, they're not supposed to be derived from the outside world. But chachma, which is general wisdom and knowledge, so there we have much to learn from the outside world. And in this particular context, we are not talking about Torah, we are certainly only talking about chachma. There are many challenges that the modern world has presented us with. There are challenges, practical challenges, living in an open society. That's not my issue right now. But there are many intellectual challenges that have been presented to us. And sometimes we do not have great answers to questions. And we could live with a question. You don't die from a question. But there are situations in which our predecessors have shown us the path to dealing with so as to remove every michshol, to remove every stumbling block. In the context of dealing with this issue, the Gedolei HaRishonim, the Rambam, even the Ramban, the Gaonim, and many of the Achronim already showed us, they already tread upon a path, they already blazed a path that we can follow in such a way that we're not required to live with a dissonance to say that science today, everybody believes X, but we're going to believe scientific things that would be considered scientific nonsense because the Gemara says so. That is a very difficult thing to ask people to do. Sometimes we have to. There are issues, conflicts between the things that people claim and things that we believe are amunos videos that we have to live with questions, but we don't abandon our beliefs. But in situations where the pathway is very simple, I see no reason to make life intellectually more difficult for people by adopting approaches which are simply unnecessary. And therefore, from my vantage point, not from the perspective of how do you apply it halachically. As I said, most poskim do not adopt only one approach. It depends upon the situation, the area, and halacha, and so on. But I think that in dealing with a general problem, I think we should be accepting of the fact that Chazal, who are our guiding lights in how we live our lives, were authorities in halacha upon which they had a Kabbalah and a Masorah, but they were not authorities on science. And therefore, if granted, modern science today might not be the modern science of tomorrow, but nonetheless, this is a case where we say, V'el ha-shofet asher yeh bayamim ha-heim, ein lecha shofet ela shebiyamecha, that when you need to follow the term in matters of science, you ask the scientists of your age, and that is not only what you should assume to be correct, but on the whole, when relevant, that is also how one applies halacha in the world in which we live. Thank you.
I know how to do these. I do this every day. Nope. Yes, save it, and then...
Thank you.